Welcome to the inaugural Limeleaf podcast. This is a show about small tech, open source, how big tech is ruining the industry that we love, and how tech co-op movement will save everything. We're your hosts, Blaine, Eric, and John. I'm John. We own Limeleaf, which is a tech co-op specializing in Rust and Go software development. We're also developing an open source project called Limecast. Blaine and Eric, if you want to quickly just intro yourselves.
Sure. Hey, I'm Eric. I've been a backend engineer for the past nearly 20 years now. Worked alongside Blaine in several different companies now, both in the video game space and startup world. Happy to be here.
Yeah, same with me. I'm Blaine on the other side from Eric. You know, him and I spent quite a bit of time on the back end side. I did a little stint in the bigger sort of tech space, you know, beyond gaming. I did some like, you know, high performance networking kind of stuff here and there. And yeah, sort of fell in with these guys after deciding that it's time to give big tech a rest and go off and do something a little bit more sustainable as a lifestyle rather than the hustle and bustle of cheered tickets and burn down charts and VC funding and runways and stuff like that. So happy to be here too.
All right. Just a little background on, well, I guess I didn't give my own background. I've been doing software stuff for 30 years, mostly video tech. Yeah, we've all been doing this a long time. At a bunch of different types of companies, everything from startups to giant trillion-dollar corporations. I guess now multi-trillion-dollar, which is just ridiculous. But anyway, so for our little company, Limeleaf, we started it in March of 2024. The goal was to just build a different kind of startup. So one that treats its members, which we're owners and employees, but in co-op lingo, we're members. We can get into co-op structure and stuff in another episode someday. But anyway, we wanted to just treat people like human beings, run the company democratically, not take any money from creepy people, which is, I mean, the VC industry has become pretty terrible. Not that it was ever great, but it's just much, much worse. So anyway, we're not going to take anybody's money. We're trying to bootstrap this whole thing ourselves. So the way we kind of encapsulate it is that for us, startup culture today asks, how do we want to get rich? That seems to be just the complete, you know, driving factor of most of it. And the question we asked was, how do we want to live rich lives? How do we want this company to be not a vehicle for us to, you know, become billionaires, but for us to live the kind of lives we want to live while having a middle class income and doing good work, helping other people, stuff that most companies seem to be very interested in doing these days. But so anyway, this is our first episode. The way these are going to be structured, and maybe this will change over time, a lot of things about this show probably will, but we'll just do a little, you know, news rundown, talk about mostly tech stuff, but touch on other stuff for sure. I was looking at the outline for this the other day, and I was like, we should also strive to have some positive, because I don't want us to just like have a show where we just bitch and complain. We can certainly do some of that, but we should probably be a little bit positive now and then. Anyway, and then we're going to have a segment called Explain It to Me Like I'm John, which, you know, you might have heard of Explain It to Me Like I'm a 5-year-old. Well, I'm slightly smarter than a 5-year-old. So these sections will just be me not knowing much about something, you know, technical story in the news, and Blaine and Eric will explain it to me. So that should be entertaining, we hope. So first up, this week in the news, we're not going to talk about drones in New Jersey because it seems like that's all anybody's been talking about for the last couple weeks. But today, by the way, this episode will probably drop a couple of days after that, but this is December 23rd, 2024. 404 Media has a pretty great piece about the whole drone, whatever, craze, whatever it is. So if you want more, if you've been living under a rock for the last 2 weeks and you want to learn more about drones over New Jersey, check those guys out. First thing I wanted to touch on was this Grubhub settlement. So for those who aren't familiar, again, if you're just coming out from under the rock, Grubhub is a tech company. It's one of these gig economy companies where they underpay people to service wealthy people, basically. And they've been around. Grubhub's probably 10 years. They've been around a while.
Yeah, a long time.
So the FTC, which is the United States Federal Trade Commission, they're supposed to be the watchdogs over making sure companies, are not ripping people off, et cetera, et cetera. They fined Grubhub $25 million, which sounds like a lot of money to poors like us, but when you consider that Grubhub had $2.1 billion in revenue in 2023, all of a sudden 25 million sounds like a lot of money. So why did the FTC, bring the hammer down on Grubhub? The settlement, this is a quote, the settlement comes after Grubhub was accused of unlawful practices, including deceiving customers about delivery costs and blocking their access to their accounts and funds, deceiving drivers about how much they would make delivering food, and deceptively listing restaurants on its platform without their permission. End quote. I remember hearing about this on a podcast that I think is, I haven't seen any new episodes for a while. It's called Under Understood. It's some people in New York City that do these kind of deep dives into esoteric stories. And this was back in like 2017 or something when these guys first started looking into Grubhub, and what the part that they had looked into was the deceptive restaurant listings. What Grubhub was, quote unquote, allegedly, what they did was they would create these fake restaurant websites. So let's say that I own Pizzeria Johnny, and all of a sudden a website would pop up for Pizzeria Johnny that I had nothing to do with. I didn't set it up. I didn't create it. It had a phone number on it to contact me at Pizzeria Johnny, where you could place orders for Pizzeria Johnny. So all these things for my business, but Grubhub was the one that created all of it. So they route these orders through their own phone numbers. And essentially what they were doing is kind of just making it impossible for someone to contact me directly at my own phone number, at my own business, to make an order without going through Grubhub.
Yeah, and it sounds like they did that to, expand their support for restaurants. Instead of them reaching out to you, the owner of Pizzeria Johnny, and saying, "Hey, we want you on Grubhub. We can make this easier to delivery. We can increase your revenue, yada yada yada." They just sort of like didn't do that, and then made the fake shell website, indexed you, put you in their system, which gave them all the exposure, to use that. But then they wanted to just use you as like a backing food supplier for their restaurant.
So they
Yeah,
did a
this.
bunch of spec work for all these companies, right? And
Yeah, that's what it sounds
they were the nice guys making all these websites,
Which is
increasing
always,
their online presence, right?
yep. It's a classic tech startup move. Like, no, oh, guys, we were just trying to help. That's always their first. And again, I've worked in these kind of places, and not that everybody in these companies is sinister in it, but the way the company culture positions itself, it's like, no, we're helping these people to grow their businesses and get on Grubhub and grow their, and but what you're really doing is you're the only ends you're serving are Grubhub's. And I've been in those situations where it's like, well, no, we're doing the best thing for users. It's like, well, coincidentally, it also is the best thing for this company we all work for as well. So that's kind of, but which I get, but then to make a system that end runs the person who owns the business. That way you make fees from, I don't know, it's just so shady. And they've been doing it for a decade, like a long time. And I don't know if people, I would imagine people going to these fake websites have no idea that it's not, that it's something set up by Grubhub or.
No, and why would they know? And I think that's sort of where we're getting used to that sort of on-demand service, regardless of what it is. Like you are in your house and you're hungry and you pull up an app that like, "I want pizza." It's like, you're not gonna question, or the average person is not gonna question whether that website is legitimately a real website, business, phone number, whatever. It's just like, "Oh, there's a picture of a pizza. I kind of want a pizza." And then 20 minutes later, I get a pizza at my front door. I don't care where it came from.
Yeah,
Right.
or
Not
true.
and even nowadays, even if you do care where it came from, if you're trying to at least like on these platforms like DoorDash and Grubhub, buy something from a local business, you also have these, they call them ghost kitchens now. There'll be these like restaurants you might not have ever heard of, and they sound great and they look like they have what you want. What I ended up doing now when I'm ordering and I see something like that is I have to like check the address, and a lot of times it's the address of like another restaurant. So I know like, oh, okay, that's a ghost kitchen, right? Like they're making it out of one established business, but it's a branded for a totally different business, and it's most likely just not even owned locally. It's not something that 9 times out of 10, it's like, all right, here's Buca di Beppo, an Italian chain restaurant making burgers or something like that, like American food. So I feel like that's sort of, while it's not quite deceptive, like I guess those are legitimate businesses in some way. It
Right.
just feels not great that I have to be on the lookout now if I'm like consciously trying to support a local business on one of these platforms that like maybe it's not as I just feel like it's along the same lines there.
Yeah. And then you get to these weird customer service problems too. It's like where's the handoff on who's supposed to be responsible for what? Once you place the order through one of these online systems and it goes to a local place and then the order doesn't show up for 40 minutes to 1.5 hours. And you call the establishment wondering where your order is. And they're like, bah, Grubhub has it. Like, okay. So now I gotta go call.
All
I
I
gotta
got
go,
was
I got,
notification in the Grubhub app. I got,
yeah, now I gotta go call the $1 billion company that has a support line that is only support for their tech and their app, not for your actual pizza order. Like what happens? You just gotta wait now.
So logistically, yeah, how did that work? Did they have operators answering phones for random local businesses and then like essentially forwarding on the order that they took?
Yeah, I don't think they've even quoted the order. They just sort of pass the buck. Like you call or you try and contact Grubhub, they're like, oh, it's from this place. You got to call them. But then like the local shop that like prepared the order has some kid in high school answering the phones and like, I don't know what to do. Like it was already picked up.
Yeah,
Here's the number
my memory.
for your Dasher or whatever. Like.
Right. My memory from the Under Understood podcast was one of the things they were doing is somebody who would call the Grubhub created phone number. It would actually get rerouted to the establishment's phone number. So the establishment would pick up the phone and be like, hello, would you like a pizza? And like, yes, I'd like a pizza. And then all of a sudden, the restaurant gets dinged by Grubhub for a fee. And they're like, what? I didn't know this was a Grubhub order because Grubhub was just funneling stuff
So it's
through
ad
their own
sales,
platform.
commission pizzas.
and I think at the beginning of all this, like the very first years of Grubhub and the like this was not their intent. I really don't think it was. And even the experience of doing that, it was novel at the time. It's like, oh, I could just, there's one place where I do, 'cause before that, how would we take the order? If we want to do something, especially for sort of tech savvy folk, it would be going to the website and trying to find it, trying to Google and find that website, which is probably built in like older tech and like their menus and some screenshotted PDF. It's like that experience is also terrible because it's a local restaurant. We just like, we want to like place an order and we didn't have a menu in hard copy in our kitchen drawer to make the order. So now Grubhub comes along and it's like, oh, it's a central marketplace for all restaurants to like place your order with a unified UI. Fantastic. The order went in and we started getting our food. And if we had any issues, we got the phone number of the delivery person, which 9 times out of 10 was like somebody local and the experience was generally okay. But after the sort of explosion of all of this, down went customer service and
What also
logistics.
is what we always talk about and what people like Ed Zitron talk about and Cory Doctorow, like the death spiral is the growth. A company like Grubhub will debut and they're awesome and everybody, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, they're not growing 50% a year like the VC people who gave them all their money. And then they start doing shitty things because they're trapped and like, we got to keep growing. And I think that kind of pressure just makes people do unethical, shitty things. And again, like you said, maybe it's not intentional. Maybe they're not people plotting in their lairs or whatever, but they are like, well, we got to keep growing. And if we don't keep growing, see
Right.
people
And it's
get mad at
the
us.
growth within the centralized model of Grubhub, maybe, right?
I would push back on this wasn't necessarily an unethical decision because if you're providing a service to someone and you're immediately charging them and they have no idea you're even doing it, that's unethical. But if you're providing a service to someone and you're maybe not charging them up front and being like, hey, we can continue this. But then again, you're also like fronting as their business and like handing out a fake phone number and all that stuff.
Right.
So,
No, I think
yeah.
it's a clear distinction between like Grubhub now versus Grubhub when they first started their first 2 years. Like there is a different mindset. I think there was a different mindset from when they first built Grubhub as like from idea to inception. None of this was probably on their radar. Maybe it was. I'm not them. But now, as a very large multi-billion dollar company, you know, centralized in one spot, and they have to support all of their decisions now, that's sort of where you end up.
Yep. All this kind of makes me think, like, how can we do better? And maybe that's the positive spin that you,
yes,
that you're talking about.
For sure. Yeah. No, I think that's true. How, you know, being aware of this kind of stuff and having worked in these kind of environments, all three of us have, how can we be better? How can we not get in that trap? And I think one way, at least,
well, if we're all pointing at the growth problem and the central problem, if you limit the growth and you limit the centralization, taking the model of a Grubhub and localizing it to a certain area. So if you had an instance of a Grubhub we're in upstate New York, we had our own small Grubhub. Actually, I think we do. It's called Melio. I'm not sure if it's in other areas, but I'm pretty sure it's only in this one. So we do have a very similar model to a Grubhub.
We're in the capital district of New York.
We'll drop this, the link and stuff into the show notes for reference. But yeah, we do have like our own Grubhub service locally that does that for us. Now it doesn't have as much coverage as DoorDash does because it's a much smaller, much more localized service, but every time I've ever had to interact with Melio, never really had a problem. As far as I'm aware, they haven't been fined by the FTC. They haven't come under any scrutiny.
Right.
But they're doing what they set out to do. They are making the gig economy and deliveries for a local area.
Been around 4 years longer than Grubhub or DoorDash as well.
There you go.
I've never used it, actually. I've never heard of it, but I've never used it.
I mean, it depends on like, I think it's up to the restaurants to actually participate. I mean, yep. Melio will go out and ask them if you want to participate in the service. So it's not like they're going to do the opposite and Melio is just going to start making ghost websites and kitchens and stuff like that on the side. Yeah. It's not to say that Melio as an organization can't, I don't know who you're going to call, but like, go set up another dedicated smaller instance in like, I don't know, upstate Texas or somewhere in the Midwest or somewhere north of Boston or something like that. And it only services a very small population. But as a separate business unit, completely independently. And that's the point, right? Their own governing instance, body, finances, all the thing all the way to the top.
Well, they'll be scouring the couch cushions at Grubhub headquarters for the $25 million that they pay to the FTC, if they pay it at all. No, I don't know how much follow-up there is on a lot of these stories, but there's probably going to be appeals and other things that Grubhub will do to pay this money. But all right. Well, anyway, next up, Trifecta Tech. Blaine, this is a organization that you stumbled upon. You want to explain what it is, what they do, and why it's cool?
Yeah. So they're tied to this other consultancy, Tweed Golf, and they're both located in the Netherlands. And I'm finding more and more places like this that are not in the United States. Like, it just seems like our European counterparts have a better handle and appreciation on some of these methods of tech co-ops, tech foundations, and things like that. The open web, open protocols, open infrastructure, all focused on public interest. And so that's where I stumble across the Trifecta Tech Foundation. And so they're like, their literal why statement is like, the internet is our vital systems for water, energy, and communication, require safe software free from for-profit motives. And that's kind of it. Like, we all consider our utilities, like, those are public interest critical infrastructure for us to live, where we get our water, our electric, our sewage in some places, you name it. Their angle is, well, all of those systems need to run somehow. And if it's all for public interest, like, we're part of a municipality, municipalities have public records for housing, for land properties, for buying and selling houses and properties and stuff like that. And you can, as a member of that municipality, you can go and you can look this stuff up. I mean, the same argument could be made for the software and systems that are running the infrastructure that you rely on. If I want to go and see how the actual water pumps are being run, like, and I'm paying for it because it's a public utility, then I should be able to go and do that. And on top of that, a lot of this critical infrastructure is built and has been running for multiple decades. So a lot of our modern technology was obviously not around for multiple decades. You go back far enough, the only thing you really find out is COBOL, C, maybe some other Fortran here and there. A lot of this stuff is running on C And
Oh, well, the little village where I live, which will remain nameless because I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but I went to some water board meetings earlier this year because there's issues about paying, who's going to pay for the infrastructure. Anyway, one of the items on the agenda for the meeting was to replace a computer. There's a tower computer that is running the water infrastructure for the town, and the guy who administers it's like, yeah, it's, you know, the machine's getting old, we need to replace it, it's just the software that it runs has isn't supported anymore. And it turns out that what is running the water systems for the place where I live is a Windows 95 app written in like 1997, running on a almost 30-year-old piece of hardware that hasn't been updated in all this time. So the board, they said I need to follow up and see if they ever did, but they said they would take it under advisement. They're like, yeah, it sounds like we should probably update that, but that's $400. That's a lot of money.
Tell you what,
So
guys, just let me, I'll do it for free. Just please turn it
I
off.
almost put up my hand and said, you know what? I'll but I didn't, you know, I didn't want to stick my nose in where qualified people are on the case, but it was just sort of, and I'm sure that's the case all over the country. There are these systems that are, they've just been humming along doing whatever they do, but until there's a problem with them, no one pays
Yeah,
attention.
and I want to sort of challenge the term that you just used, a qual you wanted to not challenge a qualified person. While they probably are in most sense, I think given how the world has changed so far, they might be qualified in a sense where they're in their bubble
Yep.
and they're just unaware. You know, and maybe that's a different point of view because we've worked where we've worked and we've seen what we've seen, but you know, all too often you look at these systems and they just all of a sudden fall over because they've been left unattended or they're devalued because they just don't know, because the people that are paying for them just don't know. Part of what we want to do is like help those folks understand that, right? And even I think it's even folks at Trifecta and their consultancy, like they want to push all of this stuff forward. So they have a bunch of open source critical infrastructure. They have partnerships with other folks in the same area. There's another company called Presimo, I think that's what it's called. And they, or their group, and they're sort of like trying to spearhead the whole memory safety critical infrastructure ecosystem. And this is all built around Rust. They've put a lot of backing into Rust because of its memory safety features, which if most of these critical infrastructure systems were written in Rust, a large class of errors and crashes would be gone. Because a lot of the stuff in Rust is just not allowed to do. You can't access memory, you don't have rights to access, or you can't read past a certain boundary and things like that. And a lot of those critical systems are susceptible to that because they are written in older, unsafe languages like that. And so exploits are available for them. News comes out about, you know, X was hacked because of a memory bug, or you know, a crash happened because of a buffer overflow. That's the big one, right? You know, buffer overflow something, things are going to be bad, but you can't buffer overflow in Rust. So like that's where they're sort of pushing a lot of this stuff for. And from what I've noticed, like I said, a lot of the European counterparts that we have over there, like Rust and the open web and open infrastructure, like that's, they're really pushing hard. And I see that more and more. Although I did see that I forget what department in the government, but there was a White House press release that actually said something along the lines of, we need to start building systems in Rust and stop using C and C++. Like, we can pull that up and put that in the show notes too. But yeah, so I mean, it is coming from the top. You know, there's only so much that you can do. You don't have to do it because it's just a recommendation. It's not like it's a requirement. But I think until it's part of being a recommendation and an audit about this stuff, it'll take a long time for it to happen. And folks like us to, you know, start building stuff like this if we want it to happen.
Well, in a future episode, we'll have to do a Rust memory safety explainer where you guys, I kind of know what it is, but you guys will have to explain to me what it really is. Last thing in the news, I just quickly wanted to touch on Paul Krugman, who used to be a columnist for the New York Times, among a bunch of other things, including winning Nobel Prizes and teaching at Princeton. And, you know, he's a brilliant guy. And if you look over the last 20 years in economics, politics, he's been right about pretty much, almost everything. He can be a little bit jaded as well, and he's called a lot of, financial crises, all kinds of stuff. Anyway, he now is rebooting his newsletter. Haven't read too much about why he finally decided to leave the New York Times, but I've canceled my New York Times subscription a couple of years ago. It's becoming the organization that I necessarily want to support anymore. But anyway, so his newsletter is called Krugman Wonks Out. Search for that. We'll put it in the show notes. There is a great piece that he posted last week about what a, his words, what a racket the US health insurance system is, and I tend to agree. Anyway, so if you're interested in economics, politics, all that stuff, highly recommend Krugman's newsletter. I only wish he would put it on something other than Substack, which is just terrible. Next, explain it to me like I'm John, which I am. Like I said earlier, you've heard of explain it to me like I'm a 5-year-old. In this part of the show, we're going to take a technical topic or a story in the news. Eric and Blaine will try to explain it to me, John, who is slightly smarter than a 5-year-old. And in future episodes, we want to have guests in this segment. So if you're interested in being that guest, email us at info@limeleaf.net or hit us up on Mastodon or Blue Sky. Again, we'll put those links in the show notes. So this week for the inaugural, explain it to me like I'm John. It is Meta's view as security breach. The headline, Meta fined $264 million for security breach in Facebook's view as feature. So those are words. I don't know what. I don't use Facebook. So what happened here?
I think so. I think the TLDR version of this was, I remember when I used Facebook more often, other than just random G part marketplace stuff, was if you're browsing the site, you're logged in as yourself. You've supplied your credentials. You can do administrative things on your own profile,
All right.
but your own profile page looks one way because you're logged in. If you wanted to see your profile page
Okay.
as someone that's not yourself, whether John, you would be logged into Facebook, or John as a public person not logged in,
Okay.
there's a couple different views. So you could, once you do that, it sort of switches
My
your view around.
profile looks like to the rest of the world.
Correct. The
Yeah.
rest of the
I'm
world. Yep.
seeing stuff that the rest of the world might not see or okay, got it. All right.
Correct. And so the way they sort of did that is, they had, once you're logged in, you have an access token that your computer was granted. But what had happened was, is that access token was leaked out so that a public person could have it,
Just grab it.
or
It's just
another, or a logged, or
crazy.
a logged in, or another logged in account could have it. Like it was granted to you, so you, John, would have access to my access token.
Okay.
And then because you then had my access token, which meant you had my credentials, so that you could then, I believe there was the There was like a video feature or share a video feature that they wanted that they allowed.
Okay.
And so you as John could use the video feature as me instead. Like post a video from my, as if it was coming from my account, as if I did it. And that was only allowable because of the view as feature.
And they were fined for this because people, I'm assuming bad things happened because people exploited this.
They're fined in Europe under the GDPR rules, which are
Just
essentially
for our
data
listeners.
protection.
Okay, yeah, for our listeners, what is the GDPR?
But basically, the GDPR laws are essentially data protection laws to protect your personally identifiable information
Yep.
within the EU, essentially. Various different government organizations throughout the world have varying degrees of this type of law. For
Okay.
example, California has stricter laws on personal information. Brazil has a fairly strict data protection laws. But essentially what it boils down to is me as a consumer using a service, certain guarantees that service has to make in order to not reveal my personal information to others. The company
Okay.
can use and view my information so long as they don't provide that information to other parties. And due to the fact that this view as feature leaked names, phone numbers, addresses, potentially it violated those GDPR rules. So all of this happened in 2018, I believe, and there were 29 million users affected. And so this fine is coming as a result of that.
So it's 2018, back when people still used Facebook.
When, 6 years ago, it took the fine.
Back when people who aren't 65 years and older, so okay.
I feel like that's minimizing it because a lot of the world still uses Facebook. But
I know. $264 million, that's a lot of money.
What's Facebook's net worth?
I'm looking it up right now.
$4 trillion or something.
Yeah. It's a
Which
slap
is
on
one
the
of
wrist.
the underlying questions of all this stuff is, I'm glad that the EU, I'm glad the FTC, that the money, these amounts of money to these companies are meaningless. Now there's the bad press that Meta will get for this or whatever, but like, I'm sure they're not thrilled about having to, and again, they will probably appeal it, or just because they're, is a headline saying they've been fined $264 million doesn't mean the EU's ever going to see $264 million from Meta. But it's like one of these root problems in the economy nowadays is companies just move fast, break things. And when they break things and get busted for it, it's like, eh, well, you know, cost of doing business, 200 million bucks. Sure. Whatever.
So I looked up their, what did I just look up and use their, so their revenue for 2023 was 135 billion. So if we just take their revenue,
right,
that fine, that $265 million fine that they just got, they could pay that 509 times.
Just with?
Just from last year's revenue.
Or 0.002%.
So, I mean, maybe the solution is that these fines start being levied as percentages of revenue or percentages. I mean, I know that in court systems as well, like there's a determination of like, what is the harm? You know, if, there's all these factors that go into how much money these, you know, these fines or Cambridge Analytica, all these things that Meta has, they just don't seem to be held accountable for anything. They just keep doing what Meta does and keep making billions and billions of dollars from that behavior.
Yeah, it just because it's easy to solve the problem with money.
It would be nice if you adopted nationwide data protection.
Yeah.
Not to say that this would prevent large companies, but one of the reasons we likely don't have widespread data protection laws is because of the money involved and the lobbying.
Yep.
And the influence that large companies like this have.
You know, which is a obviously a bad thing, but I think it's a good forcing function for individuals to start paying a little bit more attention about people think they want like less regulations because they want more autonomy over their life of their immediate family and their immediate choices. And like, this is sort of like wrapped up in that whole idea as well. If you want to go and use those big giant platforms, like this is the price or the potential price, right? If you don't, then don't. At least have an awareness of what's happening. And if you are aware and you're well informed and you still do it, that's totally fine. It's your life. It's your choice.
Yeah, that is true. There is the matter of agency in all this. A lot of people know that these companies are not great and that, but they're like, okay, yeah, I get it, but I'd really like to follow my friends on social media or they know what they're getting and what they're doing. So.
Yeah. And all of this stuff is gets more exposure because of how popular these places are. Like there's I would say there's also a very large population of people. I think we're included in that population that just don't want that anymore.
Right.
And there's a lot of software out there that just sort of does that. And so it sort of encompasses what happened with Grubhub from the beginning of this conversation to now Facebook and just all of the decisions that are being made in these bigger places for the almighty dollar. How we're looking at it now is our privacy, our agency, our lifestyle. And that's exactly our point.
Well, the tech co-op movement's going to save everything. We're going to fix all this. That's it. Episode one in the can. This month's episode of the Lime Leaf Podcast. We hope you found it informative, entertaining, maybe even insightful. If you want to hit us up, we're on Mastodon, Open Collective, Blue Sky, LinkedIn. You know, all these will be in the show notes as well as on our website at limeleaf.net. If you want to support us, you can give us some money. That'd be cool. You can make a donation on Open Collective. Go to opencollective.org/limeleaf. There will be plenty of show notes for things we've mentioned in this episode. So as I said, we are a co-op. If you want to learn more about how you can start your very own tech co-op, start.coop, so start.coop is a great place to, well, start learning about tech co-ops. Oh, I'm sorry, it's opencollective.com, not org. So opencollective.com/limeleaf is where you can go to give us money. Thank you, Blaine. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next month. Goodbye, fellas, and Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
All right, happy holidays, everybody. We'll talk to you next month.